advisors and these political bosses that have been advising him, steering him away from his fundamental values. And so he starts to become conflicted. And they set up this press conference in his house where he's going to come out and he's going to make a statement that these guys that have been advising him want him to make that really violates what he believes in. But he's going to go out and do it. And he gets out, but he has an epiphany before he goes out, and he decides, I just can't do this anymore. And so he's going to go out, and he goes out in front of this microphone, and there's the press, all the reporters, and he starts to talk, and the political bosses realize he's not going to say what they want him to say, that he's going to come out and basically attack them. And so they put out the command, shut everything off, shut everything off. And Spencer Tracy says, I paid for this microphone. Not exactly in those words, but it's in that movie. Very clearly, I paid for this microphone. Anyway, I see it's almost 8:30. I don't want you to stay too late. I hope I've illuminated you some. I have another clip that runs about 5 minutes if you want to see it. I'm happy to run it by. I'll do a real quick introduction to it. It's about 1992, the 1992 presidential primary, and the primary choice of words. The principal candidates at that point were really Paul Tsongas from down here in Massachusetts and Bill Clinton. So part of the reason I like this clip is that idea of continuity. Look for the continuity here, especially with Joe Biden's song.
The first presidential aspirant to step forward was former United States Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts. He announced his candidacy in April 1991. Though Tsongas would be the only announced Democratic candidate for the next 5 months, his campaign struggled to be taken seriously.
He had cancer. He was a Greek from Massachusetts 4 years after Michael Dukakis was defeated. In light of all that, to be taken seriously, there was no question that we would have to win in New Hampshire at the very least.
It has been the constant companion of the economic policies of this administration.
It was Governor Bill Clinton who truly began to emerge as the Democrat to beat in the primary. He had a message that people wanted to hear, but there was something more, something only a voter who shakes your hand and looks you in the eye can understand.
What Bill Clinton has is an incredible warmth, and he looks at you, and he focuses on you, and he responds to your question.
You believed that he believed in you. He knew your problems. He knew the frustrations, the anger that you dealt with on a daily basis.
Stay with us. Clinton
also campaigned with a fervor and energy that was nonstop. He and wife Hillary would spend over 40 days meeting the voters of New Hampshire, talking and listening.
Brown carried Oliver out the side door into their cars, gone. Governor Clinton gets down from the head table and wanders around that room in the Bedford Village Inn until he has talked to every single person that's still there.
But remember, I was talking to a man I had loved for 12 years.
On January 23rd, a former Arkansas State employee accused Bill Clinton of having an affair with her several years earlier. In 1988, a similar charge had taken Gary Hart out of the race. But this was a different year and a different candidate.
She changed her story that she told the person who offered the money. It wasn't true. The person who offered the money said, who cares whether it's true? All you have to do is say it, and he'll be subject to just what you see here today.
The Clintons fought back. They confronted the issue head on, challenging the credibility of the charge. They appeared together on 60 Minutes to talk about it.
Got up the next morning and a friend of mine called. And they said, you know, if he's a friend, this is when he needs help. And the truth of that statement just struck me to the bone.
Call the guy in the ROTC department at the university. And he'll tell you that I was a troubled young man, probably from his point of view, who opposed the Vietnam War, but I did not do anything wrong.
Just when the campaign was getting back on track, Clinton found himself again on the defensive. This time, it was a letter he had written during the Vietnam War. Clinton's numbers began to fall.
What we want to know is, as the president, how are you going to handle this problem? How are you going to handle this?
With just 10 days to go before the primary, New Hampshire voters were growing weary of news coverage not focused on issues. The Tsongas campaign continued to gain strength and positive attention. Bill Clinton watched his lead disappear. But rather than give up, Clinton looked to his New Hampshire supporters for advice.
And he had a meeting in a small room at the headquarters with just us. And he said, this isn't going well. He said, we're not doing well. You people know the state much better than I do. What do you think I should do?
And I asked him. I said, do you believe that notwithstanding everything that's come out, that you should be the president of the United States? And he paused. He said, I do. I said, then that's the message. Don't let all this other gibberish come into it.
I just wanted to do it as much as the first campaigning is out here.
While the Clinton campaign got itself back on track and shifted into high gear, the Tsongas campaign was forced to shift down. The candidate contracted a case of conjunctivitis.
And the last thing he needed to do was to look very unhealthy. With conjunctivitis you do. And he was basically off the campaign trail for most of the day, each of those last days of the New Hampshire primary.
At the few campaign stops Tsongas did make, he wore glasses to hide the redness of his eyes. Meanwhile, Bill Clinton was doing everything he could to revive his campaign, still looking for votes late into the night on the eve of the primary.
Hillary was exhausted. She turned to John Broderick and said to him, I'm exhausted, I'm going to bed. Do something with him.
He wouldn't stop. I mean, late at night, he went to a bowling alley, was campaigning, and stopping at another Dunkin' Donut. And he was just relentless.
On election night, the networks began their coverage of the primary at 9 p.m. The Clinton campaign knew Paul Tsongas was going to win the most votes, but still up for grabs was who would be the story of the night.
You have to go on at 5 past the hour, while they're still introducing, and take the lead of the night. And the way you do that is declare victory. So what do you mean? You get up at 5 past 8 or 9, you introduce Clinton before this mob scene of supporters, and he comes out and says, he won. Which leaves your opposition the option of claiming defeat. I mean, there's let them play off of what you've already said.
While the evening is young, and we don't know yet what the final tally will be, I think we know enough to say with some certainty that New Hampshire tonight has made Bill Clinton the comeback kid.
It was Paul Tsongas who won the primary with an 8-point margin over Bill Clinton. But Clinton would be the one who gave the best victory speech. He would use his New Hampshire momentum to go on and win the Democratic nomination for president.
So again, you see the continuity. You see the continuity that Joe Brown has given the same advice to Bill Clinton that he gave to George McGovern 20 years earlier. You see that importance of personal campaigning and working hard and the energy, the videographers in these for the Clinton people just really captured it really well. Clinton being out there tireless, going at it.
Person to person.
Person to person, absolutely. And those are the marks of what makes the New Hampshire presidential primary the presidential primary. Now, with that, I will draw myself to a close. I wanted to say one more thing about the 92 campaign is that Clinton, in spite of the fact that he became president, but he also changed the reality about the New Hampshire primary. You know what it was? Bill Clinton was the first person since 1952 to become president without first winning the New Hampshire primary. Everyone since from 1952 to 1992 won in New Hampshire first. Now, and then that maintained until the year 2016, when our current president won the primary and went on to win the election. But anyway, so we were the perfect bellwether state for a long time.
2018?
I'm sorry?
I mean, 2008?
2016. 2008, it was, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton won the 2008 primary.
With the crown.
Yeah. And then in 2016, it was Bernie Sanders beat Clinton.
And the president.
Yeah. Yes.
So just to point out, 1992 on the Republican side also continued the tradition of slapping the incumbent around a little bit, because Pat Buchanan made a strong showing.
He did.
Against H.W. Bush.
He did. And that was even more true in 2000, when George Bush got his tail beat by John McCain. Yeah. So I would just say, in wrapping up, you know, why is New Hampshire the first? But it wasn't, I think that I hope I laid out and it's clear. It wasn't anything that was, I'd like to say that it wasn't that we climbed a mountain and put a stake in and said, this is ours. It was like this mountain grew under us and we just rose up with it. And it, we never, it was never a moment that New Hampshire tried to take it from somebody else, or all we've done is defend it and tried to keep it that way. And you can make arguments about why it should or shouldn't, you know, are we representative of the state? On the other hand, we're a small state, so you can go in and go. And you know, how many of you have gone up to New Hampshire for a political event in the primary? See, we're not that far away. You can all come up and I've noticed that in events, that you'll raise people come as far away as California and even across the oceans to come to events because they have accessibility to the candidates in New Hampshire.
What do you think about the assault on the New Hampshire and Iowa not being diverse enough to be first? And that's been a lot with Castro and the Warren campaign hurling those charges.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't have an answer to say, well, yes, we are not diverse, but we're also not, I think that we're thoughtful, and I think that in spite of that lack of diversity, I think there is a sensitivity that people don't see it in that respect. I think there, in the broader sense, I think people gave just as much respect to Cory Booker as to Mayor Pete, as to Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren. I think that none of them were seen in the eyes of people that I've been with up in New Hampshire. None of them have been seen as, oh, you're gay, or you're a woman, or you're black. It's, you're a candidate for president, and I'm going to give you that deference. I think that's what's more important than what the diversity is. I could share you one last story, if you like, about how people hate New Hampshire, and has a little bit of a Massachusetts connection. So 84, Walter Mondale was the designated to-be candidate for the Democratic nomination for president. Ronald Reagan was president. And you may not remember, but Gary Hart came along in 1984 and beat him in the New Hampshire primary. And there again, people, oh, the people in New Hampshire, who do you think you are, blah, blah, blah. You know, we were the piranha, or the pariahs. So, at any rate, at that point, about a month later, I had to be down in Washington. I was working on a series of documentary programs about our congressional delegation. And I came with this idea, let's do a program about what the people in Washington, D.C. think about the New Hampshire primary now. And so my friend Chuck Burton, who had written a book, and he came up with some names, people to talk to, and got a nice list of names to go and talk to about the primary. And I got this idea, why don't we ask Tip O'Neill? Maybe we can get an interview with Tip O'Neill about the New Hampshire primary. Pretty broad reach for somebody from a little cable station up in New Hampshire. But anyway, so I called Tip O'Neill's office, and his press secretary was Chris Matthews, now host of the show is at Hardball. So Chris and I started talking. I told him I wanted to, and so on. Well, we'll see what we can do. I get down to D.C. I'm still talking with Chris. And finally, he says, look, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, he's going to pull into the document store at the Capitol building. You be there. He'll have something to say. Now, the document store, if you're standing on the east side of the Capitol building, here's the center into the rotunda. Here's the stairs up into the House of Representatives. The document store is, like, right between them, down on the ground level. And sure enough, at 8 o'clock the next morning, we're out there with me and my cameraman, and sure enough, this big black limousine pulls up, parks right in front of us, or stops right in front of us. We get around, and the door opens up, and this waft of cigar smoke just comes out, blasting like a fog. And Tip O'Neill turns and starts to get to the car, and I reach out my hand and say, Mr. Speaker, it's so nice to meet you. We got a couple questions we want to ask you about the New Hampshire primary. He looked right at me, and he said, New Hampshire, I've got nothing to say about that. And he threw my hand down and went into the Capitol building. That was what they felt about New Hampshire. Very clear. Got the message really well. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. I hope that you feel better about the New Hampshire primary now. And if not, talk to me. Maybe I'll convince you.
Still waiting.
State of the Union.
Not much truth in there.
Is this full documentary available?
You know, I used to, I've sold out of them. When I get to the it's a true disc set. And I don't have any DVD. Yes, it is available. It will be available. If you go to my website.
Do you have a card?
Yeah. Where are you guys from? Yeah.